Good morning. Well, in early India, it was said that jealous or greedy people created a particular kind of karma for themselves, such that they were reborn as something called pretas. A preta, usually we translate in English as a hungry ghost, right? So our Buddhist practice arose in this context of Hindu practice in early India. So we've inherited this idea of the hungry ghost. So the hungry ghost has this insatiable hunger, often for one particular thing. And in the mythology, the cosmology, whatever that is, often what they are craving, what the hungry ghosts are craving, is something particularly unpleasant or something particularly humiliating. This is the karma. Right? They've been handed a situation which is not so comfortable. So the hungry ghosts are supposed to have necks, which are very thin, like thin as needles, and also to have very large stomachs. So they're kind of strange-looking beings. But because of this, of course, they're ravenous all the time. They have this huge stomach to fill, and yet their necks are very small, so they can't take in. Whatever it is they think they need. They have a lot of suffering because they can never be satisfied. So the realm of pretas, or the realm of hungry ghosts, is one of the six realms of samsara, right, through which we transmigrate, which is sometimes called the rokudo, in Japanese, the six realms. The realm of the hungry ghost is not a hell realm. You know, there are many, many hell realms in this cosmology. 18 cold ones and 21 hot ones, and there are lots and lots of hells. The realm of hungry ghosts is not a hell realm, because the hungry ghosts are not confined to that particular sort of underworld. Hungry ghosts can move around. So the teaching is, or the thinking is, or the idea is, that these hungry ghosts live on the earth, and they live in the deserts, and they live in the wastelands, and they are not beings that we can see. They're invisible to our eyes, although if we practice, supposedly we can become aware of these hungry ghosts, this preta. So they have various kinds of suffering related to this insatiable hunger. So these beings suffer in different ways. Some can eat a little bit of food, and they can drink a little bit, but they can't find food or drink to take in. Some of them can find food or drink, but they, because of their very thin necks, they can't swallow. So here it is, but they can't take it in. Others of these hungry ghosts find that they have access to food and drink, but as soon as they try to eat it or drink it or put it in their mouths, it bursts into flame. Or maybe it kind of withers or shrivels up or dries up right before their eyes. So it becomes unpalatable. It becomes not satisfying, even though it's like here. Right? So many, many different ways that these hungry ghosts can suffer. Usually, I think if we've seen any drawings, pictures of these hungry ghosts, we've seen how they have these tiny, thin little necks and these great extended stomachs, and we think, well, there's one simple way that these beings can't be satisfied, and it's that they can't get anything down their throats. But when we look carefully, we see there are many, many ways for hungry ghosts to suffer, you know? Even if they can take in a little bit, it's not enough. Even if they have access to food, you know, it kind of bursts into flame. So as a result of these circumstances, these hungry ghosts are always hungry. Right? They can never be satisfied. So the Japanese word for a hungry ghost is gaki. Transliterated G-A-K-I, gaki. And if you look at the two kanji for gaki, the first one is about hunger or thirst, but there's a feeling of starvation. It's not like, oh, I'm mildly hungry for a snack before bed. It's like this starvation, you know, this just insatiable kind of not being nourished, not getting whatever it is that we think we need. The ki is an ogre or a demon or a spirit of a deceased person, right? So something kind of in that realm. Interestingly, the Japanese have this phrase, gaki daisho. A gaki daisho is literally hungry ghost great leader. Gaki daisho. A gaki daisho is the kid on the playground that's the boss, kind of the bully kid, you know? Gaki daisho. The great leader, hungry ghost great leader. So it kind of means, you know, a bully in the sense that it's a kid that bosses the other kids around. sort of the leader of the neighborhood pack of kids. You know, this is Gatti Daisho. So in this culture, in this language, we think of a bully as somebody who is abusive or is habitually sort of cruel to anybody weaker than he or she is, somebody who forces people or coerces people to do what they want, that kind of bully. That's kind of not the feeling of this kind of bully. This is a more like a spoiled child. So where in English we might say, you know, we might call kids all those little demons. Oh, you know, if we're making a joke or being kind of funny, oh, yeah, it was just packed with little demons. Japanese would say Gatti Daisho, and they're talking about a spoiled child. So the kind of playground power, if you will, exercised by the Gatti Daisho is this spoiled child who expects to get everything he wants or expects everything to go her way. So we've all known, I suspect, spoiled children. Maybe we were spoiled children, or we've had them in our family, or we've encountered them in school. You know, we all had some kind of exposure to a spoiled child, and we know what whatever you give a spoiled child isn't enough, right? It's always something more they want. They might be satisfied for this moment, but in the next moment they're wheedling something else out of you, or they're throwing a tantrum because they didn't get something else that they want. They're loudly demanding. You know, have this idea of a spoiled child. So you might give this child what it wants in an attempt to get peace, or make it happy, or make it quiet, but you've got to know that 5 minutes later it's going to start all over again, because whatever you gave this child somehow immediately is not enough. There's always something more. So unfortunately, in some ways, we never really grow out of this thirsting desire, you know, this need for something more. So even as adults, we think there's always something more we want, there's something more to which we're entitled. We have this dis-ease, this dissatisfaction, you know? And here we are again with the Four Noble Truths, you know, our life is characterized by suffering. So this might seem like some kind of foreign cosmology, but it's very much our direct experience every day. You know, we all have some experience, I think, somewhere in our lives of being the Gatti Daisho or being the Hungry Ghost. So sometimes in human form, when we encounter somebody who behaves like a spoiled child, who behaves like a hungry ghost, we can see somebody else has something this person wants, or someone else has something this person feels he or she is entitled to, and this hungry ghost can get nasty, right? Can get aggressive, can become depressed, can become despondent, all kinds of suffering. Any kinds of suffering that go with this approach to life. The small self is always demanding more and more and more and more, but yet somehow those things don't satisfy. This small self is never satisfied. It always feels like it's starving. In the midst of abundance, perhaps, right? Feels like it's starving. So these Gatti children can become Gatti adults. A spoiled child can become a spoiled child in an adult form. So, you know, yes, there are the invisible Gatti that live on the desert and in the wasteland, but we all know, just in our meeting and encountering with other people, people can also exhibit these kinds of characteristics. So sometimes we feel like in our lives, our insatiable kind of craving and aversion, right, outstrips our ability to fill the need. We have so much thirsting desire. Tanha is the Sanskrit, it is tanha. We have so much of this thirsting desire that it outstrips our ability to fulfill this. We can't get food through our very tiny necks or into our very large stomachs. There's something going on there. Or as fast as we get what we want, we realize that it won't really satisfy the craving and the aversion. Whatever we get, we think we want, and somehow right in front of our eyes it shrivels up. It becomes unpalatable. And we realize it's not. That's not it. We grasp, we want it, we didn't even work really hard to get something, and something, that's still not it. There's got to be something else. This isn't enough, this isn't right, you know, it's got to be something else. So what can we do about hungry ghosts? It seems to be so basic to the human condition. You know, what can we do when we encounter hungry ghosts, or even feel like we are Gatti, or Gatti Daisho? How can we put an end to that kind of suffering? After all, you know, at the end of this lecture, we're going to do the Bodhisattva vows, one of which says, desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Well, how do we do that? As human beings, we always want something. There's always something more, right? How do we do that? One of the ways that hungry ghosts are sometimes portrayed in the teachings or in the Buddhist culture is that they are, that there is food and they are trying to eat, but the only utensils they have are extremely long. They're so long that they can't reach their mouths. They can, you know, pick up the food, but the utensils are so long they can't reach their mouths. And here again, here's this abundance and they can't quite get what they need. They can't quite take it in. They can't feed themselves. So those that overcome this kind of suffering do it by figuring out that it'll only work if they feed each other. Right? So if I have a very long spoon, I can't feed myself, but I can feed the person across from me, and that person can feed me. So the way they liberate themselves from this kind of suffering is through cooperation, through giving, through nurturing other beings. So it becomes not all about this small self, me and my big spoon, you know. It comes about, if I feed you, you can feed me. And this is how we all liberate ourselves from this realm, from this kind of suffering. So we can imagine them sitting across the table. Maybe there's a long banquet table, right? They're sitting across the table from each other, feeding each other. And in this way, everyone gets to eat. So the medicine, if you will, for this kind of suffering is recognizing interdependence. It's recognizing that we already are not separate and that we really need each other in order to have everything we need in order to manifest our awakening. Right? It's not possible to live and practice separately from other beings. It's just, I mean, it can't happen. We believe sometimes that that's what's going on, but it can't be true. So we have to cultivate this cooperation or this orientation toward giving. What does that do? It means that instead of constantly trying to pull things in to ourselves, you know, constantly trying to grasp for ourselves and pull things in for ourselves, we reverse that flow of energy. How about instead of grasping and pulling in toward myself, instead I send something out? My attention, my focus, my compassion, my wisdom. What if I focus on something outside of me? Well, there is nothing outside of me. But what if I at least change my orientation? We'll put it that way. Such that my whole entire waking experience is not about, I have to get more stuff. You know, I'm this hungry ghost with this insatiable desire. What if instead I turn that orientation around? When I do that, I am likely to see that everything that I need is already here. You know, I don't really need to go grasping and grabbing and searching and whatever. Everything I have is already here, already in front of me. So when we encounter this teaching, I think the first place we go with it, perhaps, which is not that, and it's not that this isn't useful, the first place that we might go with it is, well, I can see that I don't need all the things I think I need. Maybe I don't need that fancy car. Maybe I don't need the luxurious clothes, you know. And we kind of take it to be about what we own. And that's not bad. I mean, to have a smaller footprint on this planet is not a bad thing. And that's maybe a first crack at this teaching, or the first cut of this teaching. But I think there's something else happening here. I think there's something else kind of subtle happening with this teaching. We come to practice perhaps feeling that something is missing. The reason that we practice is we somehow know, even if we can't articulate, that there's some suffering. There's noble truth, right? I mean, that's what bodhicitta kind of is all about. We recognize this. There's something we need to do to manifest this awakeness. And it might feel like we need to acquire something in order to do that. Something is already missing. So we come to this practice kind of looking for something. And in the process of looking for something, perhaps we go chasing something which is already here. We think it's not here or not here. Right? As we practice, we drop off body and mind. We see clearly. We put aside small self. We see that everything we need is already here. So in the meantime, we may sort of be bouncing from practice to practice to practice, or cherry-picking the pieces of practice that we like. This one feels good. This one challenges me in ways that make me uncomfortable. This one takes too much time. You know, we're looking for the magic bullet. Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm an academic, you know, I'm liking to come at it from an academic standpoint. I'm going to study sutras, but gee, I don't know about this sitting on a cushion facing the wall stuff. You know, what's that about? Or if I Or if I'm particularly used to body practices, I might think, well, sitting on a cushion, I'm flexible, I can do that. You know, I really don't know about this chanting thing, though. You know, that seems kind of worshipful, and that feels weird. You know, right? So we kind of bounce from thing to thing and choose the things that make us feel comfortable, kind of avoiding being challenged. You know, one of the characteristics of religion, at least in the West, is supposed to be that it comforts the afflicted and afflicts the comfortable. I think that's not different from what we do here, you know. In some cases, our practice is quite comforting. It's quite comforting to know I'm not separate from you. I'm not left out from anything. That's really quite comforting. And at the same time, if I'm feeling complacent, practice is here to challenge me and say, okay, what's going on with this small self? You know, what's really arising for you? What are you doing with that in the world? So there's this two halves, two pieces, two sides of one reality, my teacher would say. But anyway, so we bounce, perhaps, from practice to practice, looking for that magic bullet, never quite satisfied with what's going on in our spiritual life. You know, and yet Dogen says, if you make, in his Kokanzo Zenji, says, if you make one misstep, you stumble past what is directly in front of you. So if we're always out looking for something, are we also paying attention to what's here? Or what's here? Because Dogen says, all sentient beings without exception are the Buddha nature. Not all sentient beings without exception have the Buddha nature. This is his change, right? We've talked about this. This is what makes Soto Zen like Soto Zen. He makes a pretty radical shift in the teachings that came before him, which is all sentient beings have the Buddha nature. In other words, all sentient beings have the potential to wake up, or have the potential to be awake. Let's put it that way. His awakening experience, dropping off body and mind, he realizes all sentient beings without exception are the Buddha nature. This Buddha nature is already here. We have trouble manifesting it because it's covered up by some stuff, you know, including our grasping and craving and aversion and feeling like we're hungry ghosts. That Buddha nature is already here. One interesting aspect of this Vokudo, this six realms of samsara through which we transmigrate, which includes the hungry ghosts, is that a being in each of these realms perceives the same thing very differently. So, in the heaven realm, the gods will perceive water as ambrosia, right? Something very desirable, very tasty, very wonderful. The hungry ghost sees water sometimes as blood or something poisonous because of its conditioning, because of who it is. So, in any event, something that's, you know, not safely drinkable. So, it's all the same water. And yet, depending on where the being is in the Rokudo, it sees this reality quite differently. So the gods see something lovely, tasty, call it ambrosia. They are stuck there in that bliss. Which is why, in the Rokudo, the god realm, the heaven realm, is not the be-all and end-all. It's not like that's where we're trying to go. Because if we're stuck in that bliss realm, we're not recognizing suffering, and we're not practicing. And we're not liberating ourselves and all beings. We're kind of stuck somewhere in a happy place. It might feel okay, you know, but ultimately it's stuckness. It's being stuck. So, you know, the hungry ghosts instead see something unappealing. They're going to search for something else to quench their thirst, and yet this is perfectly good, wholesome water, which would do the job. Something we all need. But what we see is that makes me uncomfortable, that's not palatable, that's poisonous, or whatever. So here's something perfectly good, and yet we're walking away, right? So this is kind of like this gaki daisho or gaki child or even a gaki adult that says this water isn't good enough, it's somehow not the right thing, demands something else all the time. Well, I don't like this. Maybe I want soda. Maybe I want lemonade. Maybe I want tea. Maybe I want beer. Maybe I want coffee. How about seeing clearly that this is wholesome water and taking that in? But the hungry ghost isn't in a position to do that. So there's a poem. When I've done these talks before, sometimes I've included some poems by a lady by the name of Chase Twitchell. She spent some time practicing at Zen Mountain Monastery out in Mount Trumbull, New York. So many of her poems reflect practice. So this is the beginning of a longer poem, but I wanted to share the first part with you. She says, "Why would anyone want to sit cross-legged for an hour a day? Motionless, every itch unscratched, striving for clear mind, fighting sleep. Right now, I'm part human, part dog, part hungry ghost, part bodhisattva, longing for the afternoon I'm already in. So she's recognizing this transmigration through the Rokudo. In one moment, you know, she says, I'm part human, I'm sitting zazen, and I'm in the realm in which I can actually manifest awakening. I'm part dog. Well, the animal realm means we're driven by our instinct. It's not a slap to anybody's dogs and cats. I have a dog upstairs. It's about being driven by instinct. Hunger, thirst, sleep, right? Part hungry ghost, never quite satisfying. Part bodhisattva, out in the world, liberating our beings. Moment by moment by moment, this constant transmigration to the Rokudo. Longing for the afternoon I'm already in. In the beginning of this talk, I mentioned that often what the preta, or the hungry ghosts, are given to chase after is something which is unpleasant, is something which is humiliating. So, you know, here's this irony. I think that a gaki daisho, or a gaki which is manifesting as a kind of a bully, looks like a strong and independent person. You see the, you know, the bully on the playground, or even the spoiled child, which you think, well, that's a child that knows its own mind, you know, knows what it wants, and you think, well, this is kind of a strong personality, or this is a strong self-concept. And actually, of course, when we look carefully, what we see is a person who's completely at the mercy of his cravings and aversions, you know, completely being pulled around, not under his own control, completely being pulled around by these things that arise. These cravings and aversions, which seems to me kind of humiliating. Who wants to admit we're not in control, you know, of something as simple as craving and aversion? It's kind of not the way we like to think of ourselves. It's kind of an uncomfortable idea that we're pulled around, that we don't have control over these things which would seem to be very basic. You know, to be longing for the afternoon you're already in. What's up with that? What's going on with that? What are we doing? Longing for the afternoon we're already in the middle of. You know, how can we do this? Because she says, you know, why sit zazen for an hour a day? Choosing not to scratch every itch, not to be pulled around by all of these things, chasing after every little desire that arises on the cushion. And we know, especially when we're sitting and there's no distraction, we become quite keenly aware of every twitch and tingle and every itch and every little thing that's happening in the body, because we're paying attention in a way that we often don't. And yet, sitting means we don't get up and do whatever comes to mind. We don't scratch and move. And, you know, because I think part of what's useful about zazen, we see all these things come up, and yet we decide not to sort of be at the mercy of all of that. We decide not to give over the control of our lives to these little things, these little cravings and aversions and sufferings that arise. So when we look at some of the things we do as hungry ghosts, how we go out of our way to satisfy all of these little cravings and things that come up, these superficial little things that pull us around, we find ourselves wandering in the wastelands and wandering in the desert in search of something probably that we already have. So what's up with this? You know? Somehow we think that by satisfying all of these cravings, all of these things that hungry ghosts need, that somehow that's going to lead us to peace, or lead us to nirvana, or something. And at some point we see that desires are inexhaustible. And, you know, it's more wholesome for us, better for us, to work at figuring out where they come from and keeping them from rising, rather than spending that energy, that effort, those resources, and running around trying to satisfy them all. You know, the little spoiled child says, now I want candy, now I want toys, now I want a dog, now I want a pony, now I want a bicycle. If we're running around satisfying all of those things, somehow that's not getting us to liberation. How about if we look carefully and say, where are those desires coming from? You know, where are those cravings and aversions, how are those cravings and aversions arising? How do we do that? We sit down cross-legged and motionless and give up the opportunity to scratch every itch and kind of follow every little wandering desire over the wasteland. So we have to sit down in order to liberate ourselves from this hungry ghost realm by seeing our true nature, by seeing how things arise, by seeing how the mind works, what the human experience is about, which is non-separation, interdependence. Somehow we sit down, we see those things clearly, and things start to unravel. things start to loosen their grip on us. So in this way, I think we keep ourselves from being at the mercy of the Gaki Daisho, the hungry ghost great leader that exists somewhere for all of us, right? We return to this human realm, which is where we have the opportunity. The one place we have the opportunity to practice and to manifest awakening. This is our opportunity. Somehow, can we let go of the hungry ghost? Be right here. What would you like to say about hungry ghosts in your experience, in your life? What comes up for you all? Please.
I'm thinking, how different the economy could be if we were to listen to that hungry ghost being activated, and that all these hungry ghosts are rather obedient to, say, the latest device that comes out, and folks can camp literally for days until the store opens so they can get it. And I'm imagining the corporations know that there are hungry ghosts, and they would be rather obedient and to line up. But the economy would be so different if the hungry ghost can know that one can do without. So for me, I've taken a little survey in one of my classrooms, and the devices were up in the $3,000 in a classroom of, say, 15 or so, at least $3,000 worth of electronics, just, you know, handheld in one room. And how, you know, the talk is that, you know, the next version of something is coming up, and they have to have it because they're told they should have it. So I'm just offering that up as,
yes,
you know, what's important. And you say, you know, less of a footprint or clothing or anything like that. That hungry ghost is getting, you know, hey, how about it? And it seems like that's very much in play.
It is. And, you know, it's so easy to think about those circumstances in our lives and in our world and immediately say, all of that's bad. I'm not saying you're doing that. But it's very easy to say, well, there's no middle ground. All of this consumer stuff is all bad, and we should all kind of reject, well, what are we doing? Again, with the craving and aversion, now we have aversion. Aversion is simply the other side of craving. Aversion is to not want what we have, as opposed to want what we don't have, right? So craving and aversion are not different. So on the one hand, we can say, yes, we need to be careful about, do we really need to run out and buy the latest thing? Certainly there is this thing called planned obsolescence, which has been around, you know, since I was small and probably before that. And it would be easy to just sort of vilify corporations and say, well, the problem is all over there, you know. And yet the other side of that is continuous improvement is not a bad thing. New features on products that come out can sometimes be terrific. Manufacturing, designing, selling things provides livelihoods for people, sometimes wholesome livelihoods for people. All this interconnection, right? So we can't even just point to one thing and say, that's the problem. And again, I'm not saying you're doing that. But it's very easy to look around, and this is why I say that the first cut at this teaching is, oh, we all need to, you know, have a smaller footprint on the planet, and that would solve all the problems. And yet that's much more complicated, isn't it? Because human life is much more complicated. We know as soon as some plant gets shut down, that's families without income. Well, now what does that mean? And, you know, it's all of this interdependence, interconnection is very complicated. So we do have to pay some attention, I think, to what are we acquiring. And also, we have to have some equanimity about that. You know, and say, sometimes I need that new whatever. I went for a long, long time without a microwave because, and this was, of course, years ago, you know, for a long, long time, it's just a gadget. Ah, they just want me to buy stuff. You know, I'll never use that. The stove is perfectly good. Somehow I ended up with one at some point, and now, you know, I use mine all the time because it means I can eat dinner and for instance, get down to Zazen on time without having to, you know, cook and all of that stuff. So, I mean, there are ways and reasons why I can be very helpful, and yet my first cut was bad, you know, aversion. Maybe not. So how can we maintain some equanimity? How can we maintain some open mind and be skillful in choosing what we acquire, what we develop, you know, and all of that? It's not so easy.
I think it's interesting because you can take it even very literally, and that we're now starting to do that with all the food that we're eating, and we're wanting to be able to eat more and have more to the point where we're killing ourselves because we're willing to take in artificial sweeteners, we're willing to go low fat at the expense of sugar, because we want more, we're trying to fill this craving, we're not eating real food, and we're killing ourselves, and yet we don't even realize, I mean, we do realize it, but we're not willing to give it up, and just, I mean, it's that it very literally portrays the hungry ghost because we're trying to eat more and more and get more and more and satisfy with all these artificial things and never getting fully satiated.
That's so true. I mean, I look at my own food choices and I'm more likely to say, you know, I would rather just not eat that candy than eat something which is sweetened in some way that I feel like isn't healthy, you know? I mean, like, how about my having a little self-control and saying, you know, I'm going to eat a carrot or I'm not going to eat that, you know? But I think that's true. It's very interesting to watch how that has developed over time. You know, we don't want to give up candy and ice cream and fried stuff and, you know, and so...
And it goes back to the health issues that you're talking about where we're just destroying ourselves internally and we're willingly doing it to feed this, whatever it is, eat more to have more to consume.
Mm-hmm. So if we looked carefully instead and say, why is this craving arising? Why is it that I feel that I need to eat all the time, whether I'm hungry or not?
Why do I have to have a 32-ounce soda when I really need just a glass of water?
Oh, the whole supersize thing. Let's not even get started on that one.
It's consumerism, but it's also very literally.
Yeah. Hungry ghost.
Soul and health.
Absolutely. Please.
But then once you get into that, you get into the fun discussion of, well, you know, okay, I think a lot of life insurance policies will cover you until age 120, which I took to mean that when you're 60, you're still middle-aged. But, until 120, but I don't know many people that are 130. I mean, we get used up anyway. Mm-hmm. You could sit at home, never stress your knees, never this and that, never work in the garden because you might get sun, you know, and you can be so far the other direction that you don't live.
Mm-hmm.
And, there might be a little something in the kid's birthday cake, but you end up with these balance questions too. It's not so much all or nothing. You get these gray scale
Sure, but I think that's why we're talking about the thing itself is not good or bad. Artificial sweetener on its own is not good or bad. It might allow a diabetic to have a more balanced diet. So, I mean, who knows? I don't know. I'm not speaking from experience. But I'm just saying, the sweetener by itself is not good or bad. If we're taking in some horrible quantity of it every day, or if we're doing it because we feel driven by some craving, grasping, something related to small self, that's when we need to step back and say what's actually arising here. It's not the thing itself, you know. We have to watch our own motivation. We have to watch our own aspiration. How am I living in the world, you know? Labeling the thing good or bad, not so useful. I mean, you know, aspirin is a wonderful thing, and if you take too much of it, it will hurt you. So, you know, how can we be skillful with our choices such that what we're doing is supporting our lives and our practice in order to manifest awakeness, right? That's what it's all about. As soon as we're kind of deviating from that, can we take a step and say, you know what, what's actually happening in this moment? What's the reality of this moment? And what might I be choosing to kind of not look at or choosing somehow to ignore? I think it's very interesting how much of psychology, and I'm, again, not trying to be a psychologist, but how much of it I think is about improving our daily functioning through integration. Right? Because there's all these split off little pieces of ourselves that we don't want to admit are there, we don't want to work with them, we don't want to see them, we don't want to experience them. So I think much of that whole practice is about integration. And then we look at our practice, and what's our practice about? Non-separation, right? So not different in that way. We're kind of getting there from two different paths or something, you know? But I think you're right when you say part of working with those fragmented pieces is not to reject them, but to set them aside. That's not the same thing. To simply set something aside is not to judge it, value it, say it's good, say it's bad, push it away. It's just to set it aside for now and say, while I'm sitting, I'm going to leave this here. I'm not going to engage with it. I'm not going to label it. I'm not going to judge it. Just there it is. I'm going to see that it's there. I'm going to recognize it's there. But that's what we're doing with all the thoughts that arise in Zazen, right? I mean, these thoughts are coming up, and we're going to say, okay, you know, here they are, but I'm not going to stick my head in. You know, I'm going to open my hand. I'm going to not mess with it. I'm just going to let it do what it's going to do. And those are two different things. You know? So there's no judgment necessary to simply set it aside, kind of open the hand. Tom.
Another interesting parallel, kind of depending on practice in between psychology, is that the whole idea of insight in psychology is that, you know, the therapist doesn't, even though something might be obvious to them, they're not going to sit there and tell the patient, like, oh, well, I think that this is what's wrong with you. You know, they have to guide them to that realization by themselves, or they'll reject it right away. Oh, I'm not like that. And it's kind of similar to how, you know, we sit here and, you know, so no one's telling us, like, you know, oh, you have a problem with being too attached to this, or, you know, but, so we sit here to try and figure it out on our own, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I was going to say, kind of going back to the consumerism, is, so last semester my laptop, my backpack with my laptop, all my stuff got stolen. And my first reaction was like, I can't do anything. Everything is gone. All my work, all my school, all, you know, gone. But, you know, I didn't necessarily need my laptop, but I need, like, you know, because of the things that I do, you know, other people needed me to have a laptop so that I can do what they wanted me to, or, you know, kind of complete my, or carry out my role in society. So in that way, you know, it wasn't necessarily that I was so attached to those things, but that, you know, they were actually important for the things that I do, you know. So in some ways, I think that we can relate to things as kind of a means to an end and not necessarily be so attached to it, like, this is me entirely, you know.
Sure, what you discovered is I am not my laptop.
Yeah.
I am not my book bag. I am not my car, my boat, my house, my girlfriend, my whatever, you know. There is something else that's happening there. So, and, you know, intellectually we would all say that that's true. I mean, who would disagree with that and yet try to live that way? You know, try to actually integrate that into your moment-by-moment existence, and it's a challenge, right? This is why we sit down. Because we can all say the words, you know, we can all kind of recite the teachings. When it comes down to, you know, how do I live when I get up off this cushion? What an opportunity!
I've been thinking about this topic lately, and actually yesterday I was talking to a friend, and I don't know how we got into this conversation, but somehow it came up that she said, like, do you ever go to bed and right before you think, if I had $1 million, what I would buy with it? And she's like, I do that every night. I'm like, really? Does anyone do that? But I was just thinking, no, I don't ever do that. But, and then it got me starting to think, like, what do I crave and what do I desire and why do I, what's the source of those things? And then it brought back a memory from a couple of weeks ago. I was talking to another friend who said, I asked her, I don't know how this came up, but I asked her, if you were to introduce me to a friend or to, something like that, I was like, how would you describe me to them? And the first thing she said was hungry. Because I am always, like, eating and, like, looking to eat more food because I'm always hungry. And I'm just thinking, that is terribly sad. Like, is that what you think of my personality? But it got me thinking to, like, how much I need to, especially in Zazen, look at those things I crave and look at the source of them and try to improve that.
But isn't that interesting if someone said to you, if you had all the resources to acquire whatever you wanted to acquire, I'm rephrasing the question, what if you had all the resources you need to acquire whatever you wanted to acquire, what would that be? You know, if each of us asks ourselves that question, what an interesting answer, because it says something, I think, about what we think our places in the world and what we think we're here to do. And, you know, I mean, if you gave me $1 million, the first thing I would do is pay off my debt. Now, I don't have a lot of debt. I have mortgage on my house. But the first thing I would do would be debt-free. That must say something about me, and each of you would have a different answer, you know? Isn't that interesting? And what a useful exercise, you know? And I love the thing about if you had to describe me, how would you describe me? I mean, because really, I mean, recognizing that what that is a public perception of this self, you know. You wouldn't describe yourself that way, but it's what somehow somebody else is seeing, you know. It's very interesting to consider, what is my footprint in the world in terms of how would someone describe me? And if you have a trusted person, you can ask that to, give me the top three, you know, right now, give me the top three adjectives you would use to describe me. Bang, bang, bang. And do it quickly such that it's not a lot of cogitation. What would someone say? You know, that would be very interesting. And you might hear things that you felt good about. And you might hear things you don't feel so good about. And then I know what would happen. The very next thing is the mind starts to justify. If someone said about me, well, you jump to conclusions. You know, I would probably reword that in my mind and say, well, it means I'm decisive. You know? Well, you're really, you know.
Sense of experience there.
No, I'm just saying,
you're really
about
that right away.
You're really, well, but the opposite of that is, you know, you're just so wishy-washy. You never make a choice. I'm open-minded. I'm accepting of everything. Right? I mean, we're going to rewrite this immediately so that, well, they didn't understand because what I really am is, you know, fill in the blank.
Or even a justification. You know, why I am that way, because
of course.
You don't understand what I'm doing and dealing with in my daily world.
Well, but isn't it interesting to hear something we're not so happy about? And it's either they got it wrong, they misinterpreted me, this is their stuff they're projecting on me, this isn't my problem, right? And it's so easy, again, to encounter a teaching that says, well, you know, we need to look carefully at when somebody comes at us with something unpleasant, you know, we need to see that it's their suffering, and that's good. And then we can use it to justify what they're doing and saying, oh, well, you know, this isn't my problem that they're bringing to me. It's all about the other
person. It's the currency. That is to say, it's not maybe in me or in him, but it is the currency in which we discuss things.
Yeah.
And
it's
so
the relationship.
It's another facet of it. It doesn't even...
But, you know, I just think it's very interesting because for every... circumstance like that where there's some teaching, well, you know, look carefully and see that the other person is suffering. That's true. And it's also true that we have to be careful and not say it's all their problem. I mean, there's no black and white. You know, everything is this middle path. In order to be skillful, we really have to look in a panoramic way. We really need the panoramic view. We can't just grab some piece of our reality and say, this is the totality of it all, you know? There's so much more going on. When the plant closes, somebody loses the job, you know? I mean, it's so much more complicated than that. This limited human mind, we can't sort of wrap this mind around. All we can do is sit down and let go of body and mind and open the hand and just be here, you know, being permeated by it all. There's no way we can grasp it intellectually. The only way this works is when we sit down on a cushion, open the hand, Zazen is doing Zazen. That's all. That's all.